Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along. I'm Justin Briley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. And whether you're listening live this Saturday here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio, or you're part of the podcast listenership around the world, maybe tuned in via iTunes or some other podcasting software, or listening at the website of today's show, you're very welcome along. And I hope you enjoy what we've got in store for you. Here on Faith Explored, we have a range of programming to help you think through your faith. And you'll be hearing the profile later on this afternoon between 4 and 5, when another Christian in some area of science, politics, media, sports, arts, you name it, joins us to talk through their life and faith. So look out for that between 4 and 5. But today on the program, it's my pleasure to be joined by two guests who joined me last week. And we're going to be continuing to discuss some of the differences and areas of commonality as we look at the Jewish Jesus. So I'll introduce them in just a moment's time. Just a reminder, of course, that if you're interested in issues involving theology, faith, especially interactions between Christians and non-Christians, then there's a vast archive of programs to explore at the Unbelievable website. And you can find that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to other features and resources too. Increasingly putting on a number of articles from the Premier Christianity magazine. I've become the editor there in the last couple of months, and a number of resources and articles that you can find via the Unbelievable website there too. And a special offer: if you want to take out a subscription to the magazine, you can actually get hold of the Unbelievable DVD and MP3 CD of this year's conference for free. So do check out all of the links from the Unbelievable website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, I'm Justin Briley. I'm your host for the next hour and a half here on the program that brings usually Christians and non-Christians together. But today's show, again, bringing two Christian perspectives together for a discussion. Let me introduce you to my guests. You're unbelievable. Well, Dr. Salim Manoia joins me again, and he's a Palestinian Christian. He lectures at Bethlehem Bible College, and he's the director of Musalaha. It's a charity aiming to bring reconciliation between young Jews and Arabs. He told us something of its work last week when he joined me on the program, along with Steve Maltz, our other guest, who's a Messianic Jewish Christian. And last week we were looking particularly at the issues involving Israel, Palestine and Gaza. Today, though, we're focusing the show really on Jesus. Do we need to reclaim the Jewish Jesus, we're asking? Has the Christian church, especially in the West, divorced Christ from his Jewish culture? How Jewish was Jesus? Is the church guilty of anti-Semitism and much more besides? This will, of course, tie in certainly to aspects of our discussion last week, I'm sure. It's great to have you both joining me on the programme again, gentlemen. Thank you for coming back for today's show. Great to have you with us. Steve, we'll start with you this time. And we sort of got the very brief history last time about your personal background as a Jewish believer. Do you want to just fill us in a little bit more detail about that and what your own journey to faith was?
I was born obviously Jewish, not Orthodox in any way, so it wasn't a religious background, it was a secular background. So when I found Christ, it wasn't through any aspects of Orthodox Judaism or anything like that. It was quite ordinary, really, the way that the Lord led me to him. That took me 10 years. Mm. Basically, went to university, fell for a Christian girl, and then she told me that there was a third person in our relationship, an invisible person called Jesus, something totally alien to my understanding about it. And what that did, it intrigued me so much that I actually went to Israel in the end, and I went on the search. And that search only lasted about a month, and I knew Christianity was true. But it took me 10 years for it to actually go from my head to my heart because of cultural pressures or perceived cultural pressures, because there's nothing worse for a Jewish family for a Jew to become a Christian.
Really?
Do anything else.
It's a huge kind of taboo thing.
Absolutely. It's totally joining the enemy. I could become a Satanist or anything. Honestly,
many people would say, but many Jews, particularly in Israel, would recognise that they have a lot of support from certain, parts of the church.
Oh, yeah.
Nonetheless, the idea of becoming a Christian
is... the Israelis, when they come over to England, they love all these great celebrations of Israel held by Christian groups. They love them. But if I went along and if they knew that I was Jewish, they wouldn't talk to me. they love the Gentile Christians. They don't like the Jewish Christians. You know, it's this thing. And it's history. You know, you have to understand the history of the Jews in Christian world.
How religiously Jewish was your background, though?
Basically, we did Passover once a year, just as an excuse to eat a lot of food. We didn't do Sabbath. It was a cultural upbringing, so we did the
It wasn't
cultural
hugely
things.
Observant, then,
not at
in
all.
That sense.
No. But when I became a believer, the Lord led me back into looking into the Hebrew roots. I married Monica, who, interestingly, was a German Catholic. her father was, fought against my father in the Second World War.
Right,
literally hand to hand, but on opposite sides. That was 35 years ago, and it's still going strong. And the Lord has put us on a journey of trying to get into the Jewish roots, hopefully working towards reconciliation, not just between Jew and Arab, but Jew and Christian as well, because there are other conflicts in the church too. We need to work for them as well. So.
I know that by day you're an expert in IT, websites and that kind of thing, but you're also prolific in terms of producing many books on the subject. The latest is called God's Blueprint. Do you want to just give us a brief rundown of what that's about?
Well, basically, see, unlike our learned friend over there, I'm not an intellectual or professor or theologian. I'm just an ordinary Joe. But I do know that the Lord has given me a writing talent. I got this. There's a new Bible out called the One New Man Bible, which is an interesting version. It's done from a Hebraic perspective. I don't know if you probably haven't heard of it, but I'll send you one. and all I did is I wanted to have a total feel for the Old Testament as a narrative rather than looking at each book separately. So all I had was the Bible and my own notes. I didn't use any commentaries at all. And the Lord spoke to me and showed me themes throughout the Old Testament that crossed over different books, and I just got more of an understanding of the heart of God. And hopefully it comes across in the book. And it's all done from, let's say, a Hebraic perspective of looking at perhaps a Jewish background, though not going into tradition. I don't believe that Jewish tradition is, obligatory, necessary for our salvation. But just looking at the real Hebrew understanding of the actual words of the Old Testament.
Yeah, and obviously when it comes to the Jewish Jesus, is it your view that the church has largely ignorant of as it were, the Hebraic
Well, let's be said. Well, I mean, maybe a generation ago, that was a bit of a revelation. Is he Jewish? I don't think any Christian in this country could deny that Jews had a Jewish background. I don't unless you know of any that. I would suggest that is not an issue anymore.
No, it's not. But in a sense, we can acknowledge that we can still not be aware of just how impact.
That's right, because it makes an impact. It's not just saying that as a statement. It's what does it imply? It implies the fact that if Jesus was Jewish, then you have to realise that he did certain things in the Jewish way. We have to look at, say, the festivals that he took part in and try to understand you know, the framework of when he came into an environment that was already well versed in the scriptures. The Old Testament is the backstory to the New.
Mm.
Many Christians these days, you know, they won't read the Old Testament, so they go straight into the Gospels and fall in love with Jesus, and it's great, but they don't get the backstory.
And you feel they're missing out because
I think so, yeah.
They're not seeing the full picture in the full that picture. Sense. Yeah. Well, we'll get into this as we talk today. Steve Maltz, as I mentioned, you can find out more about him and the books and numerous writings at premier.org.uk/YeshuaExplored. Dr. Salim Munaya is my other guest, director of Musalaha, a Palestinian charity aimed at reconciliation between Jews and Arabs. And as we mentioned last week,
it's an Israeli charity that promotes reconciliation between Israel and Palestine. We're registered in Israel.
Okay, so in a sense, it's very much both,
in Jerusalem based.
Yeah, yeah. The book we've been talking about last week, Through My Enemy's Eyes, obviously is all about envisioning this reconciliation in Israel-Palestine. How much, though, does this issue of the person of Jesus kind of come into that? Does, in a sense, that's what you and Steve both kind of share in common, mm-hmm. As far as your Christian heritage is Jesus, even if you historically have a different roots as far as your cultural backgrounds go?
For Musalaha, the life and the teaching and the cross of Jesus is the center of our reconciliation activities among those that believe in Jesus. Among Muslim, Christians, and Jews, we have other base. It's what we call it, the base of moral values. How basically in Romans chapter 12, the love among the brethren, trying to live in peace with everyone as much as possible. So we follow biblical principles with those that don't share the same common faith that we do have. So Jesus is the center. It is a point of meeting, is the point of relationship. It is a point of encounter, of a change. It's a point of revolution.
Mm. Obviously, even in Islam, Jesus is revered as a prophet.
Yes.
But how much of a kind of stumbling block is the Jewishness of Jesus to the average Arab? Does that come up as an issue? Is it something that?
I mean, this is for me as a Middle Eastern Christians, is very strange questions. Mm. I discovered that during my theological studies with a German prior to Second World War de-Judaizing Jesus. Mm. And as a matter of fact, we as Middle Eastern Christian were responding, reacting to taking the Middle Eastern Jewish aspect of Jesus that the West did, the Western Church did. Because the church in the East stayed, grew, lived in the land where Jesus walked, the same in the hills of Nazareth and or the grapevine or the olive. He is who he is, lived. Kenneth Bailey, very beautiful, wrote it in his book, The Middle Eastern Jesus. For us,
Jesus through Middle Eastern eyes.
It's part of who we are. We also aware that Judaism, rabbinical Judaism today, it's not like Judaism of Jesus.
Mm.
The Eastern churches, to a large degree, have followed temple Judaism. Instead of the temple, the Lord's Supper took. But if you go into Greek Orthodox Eastern churches, the hymn, the psalm, the worship, the holidays are biblical holiday, that the resurrection on the cross of Jesus is an added element in explaining the Passover and all of that.
Mm.
So it is, you know, for us, we call it Easter, we call it Pascha.
Mm.
Passover. Yeah. Don't call it Easter.
Sure.
Passover. It's a whole month.
Yeah.
I remember as a child, we used to slaughter a lamb and almost crucify him and cut it, literally putting him on the stick and cutting the pieces and giving to the poor. It's part of who we are. So for me, it is strange what the Western Church took the Middle Eastern Jesus, the Jewish Jesus, out of his context, and as a result, a great loss. I'm a little bit weary that now some people in the Western Church are adopting rabbinical Jesus Jew.
Pendulum swinging too far the other way.
Because rabbinical Judaism is not Jesus Judaism.
Okay. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Everything you said, totally concur with. I mean, there was a split between the West and the East, and the purest form of Christianity was the Eastern one, because the Western one was influenced by Greek thinking. You know, Plato and Aristotle got into the Western Church, and you know, and that's when things went very, very wrong.
In a sense, that kind of, in a sense, thinking was not Jewish ultimately. The Jewish mindset is somewhat different to the kind of modernist Plato.
It wasn't just that. There was a purposeful, you know, emphasis in destroying the Jewish mindset. You know, Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, you know, they made a ruling to make sure that no Jewish practices were adhered to, that the Jews were starting to be vilified, and that Easter would replace Passover. You know, all these things came in as a purposeful edicts of the Church, the Western Church.
And
at that time, with the destruction of the temple.
Mm.
For the Jewish Christian, Jesus predicted that.
We're talking here about AD 70, right? The destruction of the temple.
Yes.
As predicted by Jesus.
And that's happened. For the Jewish Christian, Jesus is a high priest. Jesus is a prophet. He fulfilled all the sacrifice in what the temple did. Sect of the Pharisees was Rabbi Hanan ben Zakkai and later Rabbi Akiva. When the temple been destroyed, what we do with Judaism, because Judaism and Second Temple Judaism, 80% was a temple.
Yeah, yeah.
So they start developing
the rabbinical
that some theologians call it the first replacement theology,
mm.
where the rabbi, the halakha, Jewish law, and instead of sacrifice, prayer and fasting, coming, replacing the role of the temple. With time, as the number of non-Jews enter into the body of the Messiah, we lost that element, especially in the West.
Mm.
And in those 400, 500 years, we need to remember rabbinical Judaism and Jewish Christian were really competing bitterly, violently against each other.
Mm.
It was a context, who is going to win? And it was then, as Steve was talking, with Constantine, it is beginning a process where Jews and Judaism were put down.
Mm.
And go to later to European, North European culture, the root of it from where it's come has been lost, the context.
And do you agree with Steve that there has been this strong history then in the Western Church of this anti-Semitic
strain? Of course, and that's part of my problem.
Mm. Yeah.
Part of the problem with Israeli-Palestinian, that aspect that the Jews in Europe in the 19th century were the ultimate other.
Mm.
With a negative theology toward Jews that brought, and with nationalism and violently, led to the horrible Holocaust.
Mm.
No doubt about that. And that was not in existence in the same way in the Eastern Church. Eastern Church kept the Semitic language, the culture. It was part of the milieu where Jesus was. So for Palestinian Christian, you come and say Jesus is a Jew, yes, but he's not rabbinical Jew. When Jesus, the parable of Jesus about the sword, the vine, this is where we are. We are part of the land.
Absolutely, yeah.
We nourish from his land.
We're going to talk about the ways in which you see that the Jewishness in that sense of Jesus has been lost and how we can reclaim it, Steve, as we go on in today's program. But if you're listening and you'd like to comment on today's program, as ever, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I try to include as many of your comments and so on in the feedback section of the program, and that'll be later on today as well. If you want to get in touch via Facebook or Twitter, @UnbelievableJB is the Twitter handle to follow me. Facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. And all those links and references to my guests and past shows all available from the Unbelievable web page. That's at PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. And I do hope you check that out. There's loads of other stuff you can look at while you're there. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
We're talking today on the program about whether we need to reclaim the Jewish Jesus. And your contention, Steve, is that for centuries we sort of lost sight, or the Western Church at least lost sight, of the Jewish Jesus. In fact, there was a good degree of anti-Semitism that played into that as well. You say perhaps within the last generation or so, there's been a kind of more awareness, obviously, of the Jewishness of Jesus. But having said that, you reference this ultimate thing, which was from sort of early on, the Christian Church in the West adopted these Platonic ideas, which were, in your view, fundamentally non-Jewish. Now, just lay that out a bit more for us. How do you see these ideas, the theology that was developed at that time through the early Church Fathers and so on, how did it differ then from Jewish thinking as far as you're concerned?
Okay, it's a big subject, but I'll try to summarise it. The first generation of believers after Pentecost were Jewish believers. But when they died out, sort of the next generation, the generation after, were taken from the Gentile world. And this is where we get the Church Fathers. So the Church Fathers were fundamentally, most of them, Platonists. So they follow the philosophy of Plato. And that was the prevailing culture of the Greek world at that time. So when I take an example, Justin Martyr would have been in early 2nd century, one of the early Church Fathers. He was a Greek philosopher. He discovered Christ, became a Christian, but still kept his philosopher's cloak on. So he considered himself a Greek philosopher first and a Christian. And what he tried to do is merge the two together and form a form of Christianity, a form of the biblical faith that sort of sat well with the Platonists as well. Tried to be culturally
relevant.
What
sort of doctrines would that have manifested itself in terms of?
Well, the main one for Plato would have been dualism. So for Plato, the body was evil and the spirit was good. You know, this sort of breakdown between the spiritual and the physical. That simple idea just went into Christianity in so many different ways. It went into the separation of the clergy and the laity. The idea that some Christians are spiritual Christians and the rest of the laity, you know, are there just to watch the others is still with us now. The idea of a church being a building. To be able to control people, to be able to say, us professional Christians, we in that building, the only way you can be saved is inside this building. Outside the building, separation, you can't be a believer. So it forced people into the building and to be part of this system where no one could read the Bible.
And you don't see that kind of dualism in Scripture itself in terms of the what Jesus has to say, the New Testament, the Gospels and so on?
Obviously, you know, in John there's aspects of philosophy and all that, but the idea is when you just think of what Plato does, dualism, it's separation. You know, we are holistic beings. We are mind, body and spirit as a whole. You know, what Plato did and what the Church Fathers brought into the church was a separation between the soul and the spirit. So, the soul and the body. And one very, very quick consequence of that was why Catholic priests can't have families and have sex, because sex was considered physical, therefore evil, therefore a spiritual Christian must keep themselves pure and not indulge in these earthly things.
I think Salim is interested.
Yeah, yes. Yes, no doubt about it, that Greek thinking and came into the Church Father. But I would like to say a few things. The issue, Steve, at that time, the challenge for the Church Father was more heretical group and Greek philosophies than Judaism of the time. And the Church Father, in building apologetic against a Greek philosophy, no doubt have adopted quite a bit of Greek philosophy. Yeah. So it's not like black and white. And another thing is we have to be careful in saying you have Hebraic and Greek thinking. For the one reason that the Holy Land, Palestine at that time, was quite Hellenized. For example, just the basic rabbinical Jewish exegetical rules are Greek, pardes, because you had in Judaism at that time pshat, drash and pshat, then pardes, a whole exegetical tool are Greek tools that Also the numbers. Mm. You see it in the book of Revelation. Mm. Yep. Numbers are being taken from Pythagoras' Greek religious philosophical framework. So it's a world that wasn't like divided Greek and Hebraic Semitic. Yeah. It was quite a bit of mixture.
And
this mix, no doubt about it. And it's not like I want to be kind of because of church historian just saying that the world was more mixed.
Because I'm actually being very Greek in what I'm saying. To follow on your narrative about the rabbis is that when the thinking of Aristotle came into the church in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, they got into the church, into Judaism, and into Islam.
Rabbi Maimon, one of the founders of what today we have, rabbinical Judaism, he was Aristotle. Answering Greek philosophy the way also Islam at that time.
And so did Thomas Aquinas for the Catholics.
Thomas Aquinas. Thomas did it quite a bit earlier than Rambam.
I mean, it's fascinating stuff. I'd be interested in a concrete example of maybe something that perhaps many people don't take from, for instance, the Gospels. Is there a story or something Jesus did that would have great significance in his day, but we maybe just don't see it today in our kind of Western sort of spectacles on, if you see what I mean, Steve?
There are quite a few. Trying to remember it. Yeah.
I mean, it was something that I know that having read Kenneth Bailey's book.
I'm sure Salim's got a lot of it.
The woman that was bleeding. They were holding the garment of Jesus. She was holding his talis.
So this is the woman with the internal bleeding.
Yeah. And a lot of the idioms were lost in the Greek translation or just not understood. Like the good and the bad eye is not the way it's been understood.
So give us the context. This is the sort of saying that Jesus gives about if the eye is bad, pluck it out.
You challenge your literal interpretation right now. Because basically Jesus was saying, get out of the situation. He was not saying, get out your eye. He was saying
I think that's a different one.
he was saying, get out of the situation.
I'm sure the one that I'm trying to think of is there's a Jewish idiom about the good and the bad eye. Was someone who has a good eye is generous.
Right.
Someone who has a bad eye is stingy.
Okay.
So the way that parable was understood is incorrect.
Okay. So
I can't remember what the parable was now.
You're right, Steve. But Jesus had measure argument with the Pharisees. Mm. He was very close to them. Measure argument. Mm. One of them concerning that I'm talking a lot about it, loving your enemy. Mm. At that time, the Pharisees, sect of the Pharisees, want to define my neighbor as my Jewish ethnic group, and loving your neighbor is exclude the Gentiles. And Jesus challenged that all the way.
Because they weren't reading from the Torah. They were reading from their own traditions.
The Good Samaritan story. Mm. The Good Samaritan, if you don't understand the context of the Levites and the priest coming from the temple after finishing their duty, they don't need to be pure. You don't understand the Good Samaritan. Mm. So no doubt about it, learning Second Temple Judaism is essential in understanding Jesus and his teaching. Go an extra mile. An extra mile, you have to learn the Roman army. Yeah. It's not Judaism. The Roman army they didn't have trucks, so the Roman soldier has the right to ask people to carry his weapon for a mile. Jesus said, carry it to 2 miles. So the context is very important.
So it's just a lot is lost.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back and we'll continue talking about the Jewishness of Jesus on today's program. I'm Justin Brierley with you for Unbelievable, a dialogue program today. We're not pitting two very different perspectives in a sense against each other as we often do, but we're having a constructive conversation on Jesus and his Jewish background between my guest today, Dr. Salim Munaya and Steve Maltz. And do come back as we continue our discussion in a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley with you for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, part of Faith Explored, where we help you to think through your faith here on Premier Christian Radio. And doing that today very much in terms of looking at the Jewish context of Jesus and having an interesting discussion between my guests, Dr. Salim Manoia and Steve Maltz. And again, I'll give a brief intro to those both in a moment's time. But later on today, you can hear some of the feedback to recent shows. We'll be hearing what you had to say about some of the recent topics we've covered on Unbelievable. And also a mention, of course, regarding our Unbelievable Conference DVD and CD. If you were there or you weren't there, you might want to get hold of all of the content that happened at this year's Unbelievable Conference. And it was very much a day aimed at helping you to think through your faith, helping you to answer some of the common objections to Christianity in a sceptical world. And we had a range of great speakers, thinkers and authors with us for the day, including William Lane Craig, Oz Guinness, Ruth Jackson, and a number of other guests, special guests from both here in the UK and abroad. So if you want to avail yourself of that, some 13 hours or more of audio and video included, then do go to the website. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD, and it will be winging its way out to those who've already pre-ordered it very shortly, as it's in the final stages of production now. Okay, well, today on the program, I'm joined, as I mentioned, by Steve Maltz. He's a Messianic Jewish Christian, author of numerous books. His latest is God's Blueprint, looking at the Old Testament, sort of giving a survey of the kind of the narrative of the Old Testament. And you can find a host of other topics he's written on at his Yeshua Explored website, premier.org.uk/Yeshua Explored. And joined again as well this week for this conversation by Dr. Salim Manaya, who's a Palestinian Christian, and he's the director of Musalaha. You can tell me if I'm pronouncing that right or not.
You did the excellent job.
Is it okay? Good, good.
Musalaha.org.
Musalaha.org to find out more about the reconciliation that they are aiming to bring between young Jews and Arabs.
And Palestinian.
And Palestinian, yeah, no, absolutely. Palestinian Arabs. Yes. Yeah, indeed. And again, if you want to go along to the book launch as well, happening at Coventry Cathedral on the 26th of September, that would be an excellent thing to do as well, of his latest book, co-authored with Lisa Loden. Let's return to this issue of the Jewishness of Jesus. I know that for you, a big thing, and it came out last week as well, Steve, is your concern with anti-Semitism. We've talked already that, without doubt, there's been this anti-Semitic strain in the Western Church and up until recently. Do you still think there is a kind of strong sense of anti-Semitism, or is it,
okay, let me tell you,
is it a slightly different kind of thing that we see today than perhaps the very obvious kinds of anti-Semitism we saw in
obvious. It is more subtle, and in many cases it's not even realised. And I'll give you one. There was a meeting in 2002, and this was actually became the subject of an article by Melanie Phillips in the Spectator magazine, and it's on the front page. And what it was a meeting of Jewish and Christians, and it was at the time of the first Gaza conflict with Ariel Sharon, and the question was, why does the church hate the Jews? You know, what was the problem with with Israel? You know, what is the problem with Israel with the church? At this meeting were I'm not going to mention names, but people at the heads of top ministries. One actually was an Archbishop of Canterbury, mm-hmm. and he wasn't then, but he was.
Yes.
So they all sat together and they discussed, and the Jewish people said, okay, so what is it with you Christians? And the Christians basically came to one conclusion: the church just doesn't like the Jews. No reason. That was their summary.
That was their summary, if you like.
The problem is, many reasons have been given, right from Christ killers to poisoning wells to the host desecration to blood libels to communism to capitalism, everything. They just simply said, and what it is, it's just like there was this virus, you know, spiritual virus that's in, maybe not in the, but perhaps just in the British heart, perhaps, I don't know. That it's just there, and some people deal with it, some people don't even know it's there. And you know, I'm not trying to be, you know, all sort of, you know, apocalyptic about this, but it's just what they said. It was their summary, and it's a matter of record. You can see the actual article.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but would you say that I guess you could certainly point to many historical articles. You know, many people, for instance, say one of the, you know, founding fathers of the Reformation, Martin Luther, you know, you can look at some of his writings, and they're terrible in terms of some of the the things that are said about Jewish people. Yeah. But is that the reality today?
I agree with Steve that there is in the past the anti-Semitism in the Western Church was a major demon or virus or destructive and evil, no doubt about that. But I would like you to be also the language that you have used a few minutes ago. Mm. The church is anti-Semitic, hate the Jews.
Western church,
Western church.
English church.
I'm not sure. I will be careful because I meet many Christians in the West that love Jewish people, support the Jewish people.
I mean, this is not everybody.
But
not a generalization.
Steve, let's be honest about it. I do understand the history. Mm. But in the Catholic Church in 65, there is a revolution in the relationship to the Jewish people. The Jewish people in themselves are writing about it and acknowledging that. The popes came. The Vatican recognized the State of Israel. The Pope visited Yad Vashem. They asked for forgiveness, denouncing anti-Semitism, acknowledging the church past experience. There is rich theological writing of appreciation of the Jewish people and the Jewishness of Jesus and all of that. I would like you to listen to that voices too, not only to the negative voices. Those voices are constant. Their voices are strong.
I agree. They
are voices and matter of fact, I would like to say, if you talk about Martin Luther, Martin Luther also said the way to evangelize the Muslims is through the sword. So, I mean, it's a context of European concerning the others. Who's there, the others?
Yes.
The Jews, the Muslim. Wasn't good. Wasn't nice.
There's been a lot of anti-Muslim, obviously.
Yeah, because I said anti-Semitism, the racism toward the Jews. Mm. There is racism toward Arabs. There is racism toward Muslims. And we need to deal with racism. Mm. And also, I would like to challenge ourselves. We Arabs, we have racist attitude toward the West. We blame the West for everything. We also, Jews, you know, we use sometimes anti-Semitism for different reasons and as a sword or something. So it's not only they have racism. Mm.
Are you worried,
Jews use the word Gentiles in Israel?
It sounds a bit like you're worried about a certain, for want of a better word, a persecution complex almost on the part of both people.
But just to tie all this together, just one event will actually encapsulate.
But
the whole
I disagree
thing,
with Miller Phillips about the report, but the different issue.
Well, there
I mean, going, she has a political agenda too.
Well, I'm going back 800 years now. The first crusade.
Yeah.
When the Crusaders reached Jerusalem, the slaughtering of Muslims and Jews was absolutely horrendous.
And Eastern Christian.
And Christians along the way. Anyone that wasn't visibly a Western Christian.
Yeah.
And they had someone actually wrote us a little piece about it as an eyewitness. And he was saying, and then after they finished the slaughter, the Jews were slaughtered in the synagogue and the Muslims and all that, rivers of blood everywhere. They were wading through rivers of blood, singing hymns to their Lord.
Mm.
And this...
They're Jewish, Lord. They're Middle Eastern.
I hear again coming. One of the issues in reconciliation are historical wounds.
Mm.
And this is really our historical wounds, because every time I talk to Palestinian Muslims, the Jews, that brings the Crusades.
Mm.
Yes, those things happened in the past. Matter of fact, we also did it.
Mm.
We are also doing the horrible thing.
Mm.
We need to learn the lesson from the past in order to go to the future. We cannot choose what we remember from the past for our struggle and our war in the present. And I would like, in reconciliation, to bring 2 points. One of the story of Exodus, the Pesach, how God instructed the children of Israel to remember the Passover. He said to them, I, the one, heard, so delivered. Remember, you were stranger in Egypt. When you're powerful, don't do to the weak what Pharaoh did to you. And this is the lesson for both Arabs and Jews. Yes, the West imperialistic crusade and all of that, but don't do to them what has been done to you. Second lesson from the Lord said, do that in my memory. on the cross, the victim and the oppressed met. So we cannot allow the past to jeopardize our present and future.
I mean, you'd agree in principle, I guess, with all of that, Steve. You still, though, obviously feel that this is a present problem, the anti-Semitism.
I mean, okay, we shouldn't dwell on the past, but I think it's, you know, we education is important. And for those that didn't know, you know, stuff that we've talked about already, it's useful for them to know as background to why, going right back to the beginning of this programme, why I was so terrified that my parents would turn their back on me for becoming a believer, that I didn't tell them for 10 years, or I didn't become a believer for 10 years. That was out of fear. And that fear was because of the, you know, the fact that Christ was seen as...
the record of Christianity.
Yeah, the actual record. So I had to set the context for that. And that, you know, and that's just one of many, many examples in history.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, okay, you've suggested, though, that there's some kind of a spiritual battle presumably going on as regards the views of people towards the Jews, that there's been this strain of anti-Semitism through history and so on. Are you prepared to see that? I mean, from what I'm hearing you see from you, Salim, is that no, it's not just anti-Semitism, though. It's racism has existed towards from all kinds of people towards all kinds of people. And we shouldn't see that in isolation. Is that the danger, I suppose, is that if you do end up saying the Jews have a special place in God's eyes and B, this special history of persecution, that you do end up sort of, I don't know, ring fencing Jewish people as having a special authority.
I can see how you would say that. But honestly, if you knew every nuance of Jewish history and the vast catalogue of reasons people have given for hating Jews, no historian has been able to explain it. And the only way it can be explained is that there is something going on that mortal man cannot understand. There has to be a spiritual aspect to it.
And you believe this spiritual aspect is to do with the part the Jewish people play in God's ultimate...
Well, without going into theology, let's just say there's a devil out there and he hates the Jews. Let's just leave it at that.
Do you think the devil hates the Jews more than anyone else?
I think devil hurt humanity.
Yeah.
Human being created in God's image. And I do not deny, and I don't want to deny, and matter of fact, that the Jewish has part, or they have their part in suffering as a result of religion, racism, and because of also religious reasons. But I think the people that the most suffered in the world are black women.
Well, yeah, if you're talking about...
If you talk about who suffered the most, black women.
Yeah.
So we're not in competition who suffer more. Is it Armenian or is it who suffer more? That is not helpful. We need to be careful from self-fulfillment prophecy. And I would like to say to Steve, yes, there is anti-Semitism. Siege mentality, it's not going to be helpful. Saying that the whole church is anti-Semitic,
the English church,
is not right. Because I find in the churches more welcoming support to Jewish people than to Palestinian Christian. And I would like to say another thing is, it is really important in order to deal with that. If you have, we cannot, and I have to be here very clear. The recent events that we have in Europe and demonstration, it's not pure anti-Semitic. There are people taking advantage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to vent their anti-Semitic feeling, but there are a lot of people are very concerned about what happened in Israel-Palestine, are very concerned about the measures that happened in Gaza. They are genuine people. Mm. And I think that the situation of the Jewish people is different. You have a state, very powerful state, international recognition. And my problem that you are asking, immunity from criticism. And every time I raise questions or people about your behavior, you say anti-Semitic, or Islamophobia. Mm. We need to hear each other. We're living in the world that we need to. You're being critical of the church. I agree with you. I support you. But let's be critical of each other.
Yeah. All I would say about going back to last week's discussion, the situation in Israel, I don't think there are many countries living in the world today where they're surrounded by neighbours that simply want to kill them.
I'm talking about Hamas. Hamas is not all the neighbours. That's not true.
The neighbour that's causing the problem Hezbollah.
The Jordanian had peace agreement. They want to live with Israel.
Oh, yeah, I'm not saying all neighbours.
The Egyptian... Don't use that. It doesn't work anymore, Steve.
No, I'm just saying
Hamas is a very small organization. And we already talked about it, that I disagree with their ideology and their behavior and everything. But Hamas doesn't represent the Muslim world, the Arab world. And in matter of fact, Israel worked with Egypt against Hamas in this time. Don't use that language. It's a language of the victim mentality.
Are you making the problem worse in that sense, Steve, if we're kind of painting it in that way?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you feel for the plight of those, you know, where there is an injustice done against Jewish people. I mean, let's bring this back to Jesus, because that's where we started and we moved some way off that. But what do you think then the church will gain by, as it were, re-engaging with the Hebrew roots of its faith?
What's
to gain from as it were, going back and reinvestigating and asking where...
I think just the appeal of actually going back to the mindset that Jesus himself had. And you know, 2,000 years have gone by since then, and lots of stuff from outside, including Jewish tradition. Traditions from the church, from, you know, every church you will go to, whether it's Church of England or Catholic Church, will have their own laws and regulations on top of what the Bible says. You know, it's the same in Orthodox Judaism as it is in the church. The idea of being able to strip away all those different layers, go back and try to get as close as you can to a people. Remember, they didn't have, like, compared, say, a first century Jew to a 21st century Jew. 21st century Jew may know a bit about the Bible, but they also know about MTV and the internet and, you know, the distractions are unbelievable. In those days, they had the scriptures and that's it.
They were soaked in it. It was their worldview.
Jesus, at the age of 30, would know the Torah by heart.
Question, I would like to add something. What is the dangers of losing the Jewishness of Jesus?
Yeah.
I think it's more than that. And may I help you, Steve?
Absolutely. No, you
I think Kenneth Bailey, in his book, Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes, not only talk about the Jewish background, Jesus, also Middle Eastern culture, the agriculture, the people, the thinking, and all of that. And they added a lot of understanding to what Jesus is and taught and did. I'll say another thing that is very important. By denying the Jewishness of Jesus, we are denying Jesus as man, his humanity. That is a problem. Yeah. That is even bigger problem for me. Denying the Jewishness of Jesus is denying his humanity, that he was a man and a God, that he experienced all our experiences and went on as a human being on the cross. So he's a son of David, but he's also the son of God. To a certain period in the church, we did Jesus as divine, and we neglected his humanity, and as a result, we had all other problems. Not only his Jewishness is dealing with the issue of human and community endeavors. Our problems with sexual identity, a whole line of things of that. So, when you talk about the Jewishness of Jesus, we need to talk about the humanity of Jesus, and the humanity of Jesus is essential aspect who Jesus is. So, more than your only Jewish, I do understand it. Your Jewish narrow, wide want to restore the Jewishness of Jesus for your community.
That's just the start.
I want to restore back that Jesus was a human being that had been tempted, experienced, dealt with social injustice, and other aspect, as you and I dealing with that, can we learn from him? And we can.
Yeah. Jesus is still Jewish and he'll come back Jewish.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Will Jesus come back as a Jew? Yeah. As a Jew? Well, yeah. I mean,
what's he changed?
But that's not the important question, how he came back.
I mean, what's interesting to me, though, is that as much as you say, obviously, he was Jewish, that's evident from the place he was born and the context and so on. At the same time, what the Gospels give us is a man who upset a lot of Jewish people at the same time. You know, he was a pretty unconventional Jew in some ways. In the things he said, the way he took the Jewish law and gave a new spin on it, a new interpretation, he said he wasn't discarding it, but he was saying he was fulfilling it in some way. Yeah. So what do you do with the fact that Jesus was also, in some sense, somewhat atypical of his time and his culture?
All he wanted to do is return to purity, you know, just get back to the word of God.
By purity, I mean, the problem is, I suppose, in the context of the people he was talking to, purity would have meant obeying in a very legalistic sense a certain set of rules that had come down.
I mean, for example, the Sabbath, I mean, the rabbis had added hundreds and hundreds of rules onto the Sabbath about what you can and can't do on the Sabbath. It's still there now. In Orthodox, it's even worse now. And Jesus was saying, well, he was provoking them. He was, you know, he was picking the corn on the Sabbath. He was healing on the Sabbath. And he was basically saying, you know, forget about your rules and regulations. It's going to what the spirit of the word of God actually means. You know, the Sabbath is there, but it's not. Firm set of rules. That,
but he was more than that, Steve.
I'm sure.
Jesus was coming and saying that he interpreted the Torah according to the prophets, not according to the tradition of the fathers. But Jesus come, and the gospel comes and saying to us that in Jesus, the Jewish people have fulfilled their destiny, their mission, by bringing the Son of David, the Son of God, that brought salvation to the world. He is the seed of Abraham. And we should not, and I do understand in the light of being a Jew and minority, the light of Western church history with the Jewish people, that you want, and I cherish that very much, you want to raise the distinctiveness of your Jewish identity and to keep it. But Jesus was not only coming to correct Judaism of his time. He come and said to them, what God have promised to Abraham today is being fulfilled. Jesus is the Messiah of Israel and the world. And that's the reason we need to worship him.
But it wasn't the end of the story. There are plenty of other promises about the Jewish people that weren't just about the seed that Jesus became, but also the future return of the Jews to the land. The negative stuff about, you know, because of their disobedience, perhaps because they rejected their Messiah. Look what happened in 2,000 years. You can read it in Deuteronomy 28. And you can virtually word for word what actually did happen. But always a promise of restoration. So whether there's a promise of restoration...
Only in the cross of Jesus. Romans 9-11 talk about restoration in him. There is no other restoration for the Jewish people outside the Messiah. This is our argument.
I mean, but you're saying, Steve, that yes, of course Jesus came for the world. He came for Jew and Gentile. Yeah. But he was still concerned about the Jew specifically and that the promises that are specific to Jewish people.
Yeah,
you believe that Jesus...
Yeah, absolutely. But he didn't actually speak overtly about it because for him it wasn't relevant. He was coming for the world. He spoke about end times. He spoke about, you know, why he was there and what his message was. Because he didn't speak specifically about the Jews being dispersed and then coming back, people say because of the silence in that, it means he didn't actually believe that. But I'm saying you can't actually create a doctrine out of silence.
But this is where we come to history. There's two dangers where I see it here. One danger is you slide without being aware to two covenant theology. We have one covenant. We have one God. We have one cross. In the cross of Jesus, what Paul said in Romans, that he, as a Jew, from the tribe of Benjamin, believing in Jesus, he is a proof that in the Messiah there is Jewish believers and non-Jewish believers. That's what the Father intended from the beginning. So against replacement theology, that's what Paul is saying. The existence of Jewish believers in the Messiah. We have been grafted into Paul and Peter, the Jew. And that is really key things. But the language you use can let us hear or make us think that you're talking about
two separate covenants.
Two separate, and that is very dangerous. And that
do you believe in the idea of two separate covenants?
Well, you have to define what the covenants are. I mean, there's a covenant with Abraham, which is everlasting. Then there's the Mosaic covenant. And then there's the New Covenant. There are lots of minor covenants. But Jesus, in a sense, fulfilled the Abrahamic covenant.
Well, I was going to say,
there's still physical promises as well.
And obviously this is a point of contention in terms of whether these physical promises were in some sense fulfilled in the universalizing aspect of Jesus' ministry and so on. But we're probably straying again into obviously areas that we covered to some extent in last week's show. And I'm aware of time, and we're going to have to go to another break before we start to wrap things up. And it'd be interesting to hear again just some of the aspects in which, you know, on a positive front, we can learn from the Jewishness of Jesus as well. So we'll maybe try and talk about that briefly as well.
I mean, also Kenneth Bailey, there is one thing that Kenneth Bailey brings. Lost Arabic and Aramaic commentary from early church that we have not used, that there are in existence, that bring Middle Eastern, Semitic, Aramaic, closed language culture to Jesus' time about the scripture that we have neglected. But there is one thing that among the historians...
What we'll do, we'll take that in a moment's time, just for time, because we're approaching the end of this, and we'll come back to you, Salim. Fascinating discussion, though, today. Sort of second part of two, really, between my guest, Dr. Salim Monaya, a Palestinian Christian and director of Musalaha, a charity focused on trying to bring reconciliation between young Jews and Palestinian Arabs, and Steve Maltz, my Messianic Jewish Christian guest, again, join us on the show today as we look at the Jewishness of Jesus. So do join us again for the last part of today's program here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable. Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And today on the show, we've had Dr. Salim Monaya and Steve Maltz for a second round talking about the Jewishness of Jesus. And we're going to conclude their discussion in just a moment's time. Later on today, in about half an hour's time, you can hear the profile interview today. So do stick around for that as we bring you another key person from another walk of life joining us on Faith Explored. By the way, Faith Explored is also something you can read about in the pages of Premier Christianity magazine. You can find them at premierchristianity.com, and many of the topics, subjects and guests who join me for Unbelievable are also reflected in the pages of the magazine, so well worth checking out if you haven't before, as I interview some of the key skeptics of Christianity and we hear responses as well. So do check that out. You can find some of the articles with the Unbelievable webpage as well, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Next week on the program, if you come back for Unbelievable, either here on the radio station or online, you're going to hear kind of what we do a lot of the time. It's an atheist Christian discussion. And my guest then will be James Croft, who's actually a sort of humanist chaplain of sorts. He's actually in training, at least, as a pastor of sorts to a secular congregation. Well, he's going to be in discussion with Callum Miller, who's a young Christian apologist. And they're going to have quite a philosophical discussion next week on whether the life, the universe and everything is best explained by a Christian worldview or an atheist worldview. So come back for that next week. We'd like to do pretty big subjects on Unbelievable, and that's certainly a big one next week. So that's going to be interesting as James Croft and Callum Miller go at it next week. So look forward to that one. But right now, let's finish up today's conversation between my guests, Salim and Steve, as we talk about the Jewishness of Jesus.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And just as we were kind of coming to a conclusion on that part of the last programme, Salim, you wanted to kind of come back to this scholar that you've referenced already.
I would like to say 2 points. One of them, in the body of the Messiah, we need to keep the Jewish distinctiveness. But we cannot... I don't believe in two-covenant theology. It's... and in this Jewishness, distinctiveness in the body of the Messiah, we need to cherish and appreciate Jewish history and culture and contribution. And in matter of fact, that is a very important aspect theologically that I don't have the time to go about it. There is another aspect that most of the historian that really that you study there, the whole notion that the Jewish people, with the destruction of the Second Temple, left the land, and those Jewish people are coming to the land, Jewish historian also and others will say the picture is not black and white. As a matter of fact, the Roman, when they destroyed Jerusalem and changed it to Elia Capitolina, changed the word Judea and its area to Palestina, the Jews continued to live in the land for century upon century. Some left, of course, before and all of that. But Jews continued to live in the land. Some of them converted to Christianity, and the majority of them, a large number of them, converted to Islam. And Judaism as religion was missionary, religious movement. In the 4th century, 4 Arab tribes in Yemen converted to Judaism. In North Africa, you had Jewish kingdom. So the whole story is that the Jews are coming today back to the land. Are the Jews or ancestors of the Jews are left? Some of them, yes, but a lot of them are not. So many times we use this. It is our narrative, and we need to be careful about our narrative. The same things Palestinians would say, we are the indigenous people of the land, and we are where they're all the time, and all of that. That is not true. Historically, some of us are, and some of us are not. Some of us came to the land because they built the railways during the Turkish period. Some of us been brought to be soldiers by the Ottoman Turkish Empire, the Czechs, you know, and other group. So I think we both need to be humble in our looking in our history.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you could agree with much of that, Steve. But, I mean, when it comes ultimately to this issue of the Jewishness of Jesus, you've said about the anti-Semitism that's existed down the years. What's the best way, if it still does exist at any level, of countering that? And what would you give people as a starting point for re-encountering the Jewish Jesus? I mean, because I don't think you're an advocate, if you like, at the extreme end of the Messianic movement, of us all going back to wearing the shawls blowing the trumpets and all the rest of it. If people want to do that, okay. But what would you like to see the average Western Christian who doesn't perhaps share your cultural background doing in this circumstance?
Something that they could start with is just to acknowledge, like the biblical festivals, that even though that people call them Jewish festivals, in fact they're in the Bible, so they're biblical. Leviticus 23, you've got the Passover and Pentecost or Shavuot, its original name, Tabernacles, etc. The thing is, if you go into them and if you celebrate them in the way they should, Jesus is so much in the centre. The teaching, they teach you so much about Jesus that tend to be missed out. I mean, Passover, which is obviously where Easter came from, you know, is based on the Passover service, the Last Supper. You can see the connection between the two, and the themes are the same. And you know, there's so much richness that people are losing out on as Christians, and just for their own personal enrichment, in looking back into these Old Testament themes are useful.
I don't have a problem celebrating the biblical feast. I just want to say my experience that many churches think the Passover Jewish people celebrate today, reading the Haggadah Pesach, this is the way Jesus did. Jesus did not. No. The way the Passover that many churches do, the Samaritan, if you go to the Samaritan Passover, this is where the way Jesus did it. Quite a bit of a portion of the Haggadah of Pesach, the reading in the Passover, is apologetic against the early Jewish Christians that Jesus is the Messiah, is Moses.
I certainly wouldn't advocate
it. So when we say celebrate the biblical, Passover, it's not rabbinical from my point of view, because rabbinical, the way you celebrate rabbinical many times for being prosecuted too, it's apologetic against Jewish Christians.
But there are messianic Haggadahs now. There are messianic sort of blueprints for how to do a Passover in a Christian sense. I know what you're coming from there.
Yeah, you know, I'm coming from saying let's celebrate it biblically, but many churches just take rabbinical and they celebrate.
And they think that's the Jewishness of Jesus, and it's
it's not.
Sure.
And also pray for the peace of Jerusalem for Jews and Palestinians, because obviously both live there.
Yes,
you know, not
indeed.
Just a Jewish thing, but just pray for the peace of Jerusalem
and all its inhabitants.
Whoever they are.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining me again, gentlemen, on today's show. It's been really, really great to have you for 2 weeks. Thanks for giving up the time. And again, if you want to find out more about Salim and the book as well, musalaha.org for the charity. Through My Enemy's Eyes is the name of the book he's co-authored with a Messianic Jew, Lisa Loden. And the book launch is 26th of September, 11 a.m, Coventry Cathedral. You can turn up and go, or you can check out the website and find out more as well. And equally, Steve, if you want more information about you, where's a good place for people to go and find it out?
Go to kesherweb.com.
Kesher, how do you spell Kesher?
KESHERWEB.com.
Okay, kesherweb.com.
Is a Hebrew word that means connection.
Great, and all the details on the books and so on there as well. Yeah. So great to have you both on the program.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in. Thank you, Steve.
And I hope you've enjoyed these two discussions that we've featured our guests on in the last 2 weeks. And do join me again in a moment's time as we hear some of your feedback to recent weeks of programs.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you want to get in touch with me, why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Great to receive your messages about today's programme, or wherever you stand on this. And it's also lovely to hear from you via Twitter and Facebook. @UnbelievableJB, if you want to follow me there, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to get hooked onto the Unbelievable Facebook page. Those links and links to other ways to listen to the programme, past features and much more besides from the website of premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. It's looking really nice now, the website. We've done a lot to improve it in the last couple of months. And if you go there, you'll find it all laid out very nicely with all the past episodes that you can view, special features, and increasingly posting up a number of articles that I've written for Premier Christianity magazine as well. Quite a lot of the content that you'll find from Unbelievable now finding its way into the pages of the magazine that I'm now editing. Exciting stuff. And if you haven't already heard, there is a special offer. If you're interested in purchasing the Unbelievable DVD and audio MP3 CD of this year's conference, then you can actually get that for free when you subscribe to the magazine. So if you've been interested in possibly taking out a subscription to the magazine, I'd encourage you to check out that as well. And you can find that from the Unbelievable page, or go to the DVD ordering page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable DVD. Hello to Matt, who says hello from America. Wanted to say thank you for the content. It was through Unbelievable introducing me to people like Bart Ehrman that I began to seriously investigate what I've taken for granted most of my life, only for my faith to be strengthened by what I found. I think Justin does a good job of being fair to both sides of the discussion. I also think that he himself is a good argument for faith in Christ. He has heard from the brightest and most persuasive minds in atheism, and his faith doesn't seem to be shaken. Speaking of Dr. Ehrman, it would be great to hear a discussion between him and Tim McGrew. Both seem extremely knowledgeable, but land on completely different ends of the spectrum. I've watched lectures of both on YouTube, but can't seem to find them interacting with each other. Yeah, that would be an interesting one. Thank you very much for the suggestion. I'm sure we are going to get Tim McGrew on again at some point in the future. Good to hear from you, though, Matt. Thanks for emailing in. Let's go to some of your emails that are covering the Wayne Grudem and a Richard Glover debate of a couple of weeks ago. Wayne Grudem is well known as a conservative voice in Reformed theology. He's written a number of books, a systematic theology. He's known also for his conservative take on economics. And in his most recent book, The Poverty of Nations, he sets out a case for wealth creation in the world and particularly criticizes pouring foreign aid into developing countries. Well, he had that debate a couple of weeks ago with Richard Glover, who's an Australian economist and theologian here on the programme. It was really interesting actually to cover something we don't often do, those kinds of economic social issues. And a lot of you have been emailing in, also quite a lot of response on the Twitter to that episode. Here's Demasu, who says, I hope to read Grudem's book, but is he not making a swift generalisation when he says that aid goes to corrupt officials' pockets? We know of schools, clinics and roads built through aid. It's unavoidable to employ people to work on aid projects. Many of these people are as hardworking as anyone can be. Solomon in Denver, Colorado says, great show. Could have been much better, though. My own biases will become apparent in a minute, but I must voice my distaste for Wayne Grudem's almost constant strawman caricaturing of Richard Glover's positions. So frustrating to listen to someone who cannot reasonably restate their opponent's position. I love a recent tweet by Tim Keller where he said, do not assign a position to an opponent that they will not own. Always put their argument in the best light. I started adulthood as a politically conservative Christian. I even voted for George W. Bush in 2004. But as I grew in my understanding of the Bible, I was led to filter my political leanings from biblical prescriptions for this one simple fact. While Islam and Judaism include prescriptions for governmental systems, Christianity does not. It is not a theocracy. It was born in persecution, and its foundations are rooted in the care of fellow persecuted believers, not in law and governance. That led me to adjust my political positions to something more of the order of a modern European democratic socialism. It's a system, when done well, that leads to the protection of the extremely poor and the reduction of extreme wealth, leading to more harmony and equality within a society. One of the fundamental disagreements I have with Grudem's philosophy is that taxation is not theft. It seems the vast majority of his points were driven by his presuppositions about the nature of government. The truth is, the massive growth in the American economy that he grew up in as a post-war baby boomer came during a time when taxation on the wealthy was the highest in history, and the US had an economically protectionist government. Glover is right. Our current long, slow slide is only made possible by those two decades of incredible protectionist growth and expansion. Anyway, you say you enjoyed the show anyway, and thank you for that email. Let's go to Michael, shall we? In today's discussion, Wayne Grudem kept asking for examples of foreign aid ever working. Seems to me all present managed to neglect Germany, Japan, and all the other nations restored by the Marshall Plan in the years after the Second World War. Now, we may not have actually sort of mentioned that, but I must say Wayne does tackle that in his book and believes that they're an exception, as it were, a sort of a different case in point whereby you're essentially rebooting what was already a kind of developed economy with the infrastructure and so on in those particular examples. And he sees them as different to what's being attempted when trying to pour aid into developing countries. But that aside, you go on to say the Bible can indeed be used to support the theory of a free market economy. But let's remember that the natural resources used by the Israelites to build their nation were acquired by invasion, genocide and ethnic cleansing. As for each man being allowed to keep the fruits of his own labour, we must also remember that both the Old and New Testament give instructions for the ownership of slaves. We can all agree that corrupt African states are poor candidates for uncritical foreign aid. But last time I checked, most of these venal regimes are former colonies of European nations. Perhaps the legacy of natural resources and the creation of enforced markets by Bible-reading Europeans set too strong an example. In closing, while I'm not a Christian, and I could have detected that possibly from the email, Michael, you say, I remain moved by the Sermon on the Mount, the parable of the Good Samaritan, and Matthew 25, 34 to 40. As always, very best regards. And you give a PS here. Give no heed to the few atheist spoil sports who have been sending you nasty grams of late. Anyone who does not appreciate the tremendous ecumenical value of the dialogues you host should be allowed to quietly return to the rabid atheist echo chambers from whence they sprang. Thank you very much, Michael. Here we go. Kent says, I enjoyed the show from Australia, but I couldn't believe that you and your guests could discuss the issue of the Bible, economics and poverty without bringing up the only God-designed economy mentioned in the Bible, that of the sabbatical and jubilee years, where debts were cleared, slaves freed and land returned to its ancestral owners. This economic system addresses many of the issues your guests touched on, including poverty, redistribution and private property. Talk about the elephant in the room, says Kent. Let's go for another one here. Kyle, who says, I just listened to the show with Wayne Grudem and Richard Glover. As a devout believer who works in the world of business, I was intrigued by the topic. I believe that we as Christians have a social responsibility to care for the poor, as read in Scripture. However, what that looks like from a global perspective can be difficult to resolve. I side with Grudem's conservatism on both theological and economic paradigms. We are in agreement that foreign financial aid from prosperous nations to developing countries is not a good long-term solution to global poverty, but only creates dependency from those receiving aid. These episodes concerning global issues are very interesting, and I've looked forward to the discussion about the Gaza conflict. Well, we aired that, obviously, last week, Kyle. Maybe a suggestion for another global issue? The ISIS persecution of Christians in Iraq, another appalling travesty, along with the Israeli-Palestine conflict. Many people think it's wrong for the US to militarily intervene. The big question is whether we as Christians should support violent involvement to end genocidal atrocities or to take the pacifist approach. Normally, I'm more for peaceful dialogue, but it's come to a point where a forceful hand is needed to stop the madness. Anyway, thanks for being a great mediator for these discussions. You make my Mondays at work that much more bearable, says Kyle. As I mentioned in a recent program, actually, Kyle, that whole issue of pacifism, just war, whether there are times when Christians do need to use military force, is something we're planning to tackle later on in the year. Hoping to get that actually in the can in time for Remembrance Sunday here in the UK, which is in November. And two great guests, and I'll say who they are once they're sort of nailed down, who could be bringing both sides of that debate to the discussion. Okay, thank you very much. Let's hear from Carl. Economics is not an easy subject from a theological perspective, since it appears to be entirely secular. However, I think many clues went begging last Saturday. Your first speaker, and I assume you're speaking of Wayne Grudem, referred to the 10th commandment, you shall not steal your neighbour's goods. This isn't the 10th commandment at all. The word is coveting, and its meaning is entirely different. Coveting is the key to understanding economics, since that is a subject concerned with its measure. On that front, one can see that economics is built into the Bible from the start, since the land of Canaan actually means the land of acquisitions. And the aim of entering the promised land has a lot to do with a developing reciprocation between God and man, much as is symbolized by buying and selling. Indeed, the name of the Levitical priesthood is derived from a word interpreted as clinging, but is itself derived from trading. When, however, there is no trade and religion is rejected, the injunction and warning that comes from virtually every prophet, as well as Moses, is that we will eat and never be satisfied. It's clear that this warning has gone unheeded, however, since the sense of not enough and excess and power economics has led to the insatiable appetite that is currently the norm in economics and which is the largest contributor to poverty. Ironically, therefore, the truly poor are those whose aims and ambitions is to covet more and more, and they do not need to steal to do so. Everything is set up to accommodate it. They eat and are never satisfied. Perhaps if we concentrated more on the meaning of the Bible and its application to ourselves and put religion first, would we not be more like the widow of Zarephath, who was instructed to feed the prophet first from her meagre larder and only then her son and herself? How else are we to understand such passages in the Bible? Okay, thank you very much. Let's hear from quickly from Derek, who says, as a humanist, atheist and ex-Christian, I have noticed how bringing the Bible into decision-making is usually unhelpful. Your programme last week between two erudite Christians about world poverty was the perfect example. There were a number of practical empirical questions, such as whether foreign aid generally gets to those who need it or whether developed countries did their developing behind high tariff barriers, etc. Well, the Bible added almost nothing to the discussion. It only brought more grounds for disagreement, in my opinion. OK, thank you very much, Derek. But a variety of views there on that programme a couple of weeks ago. And if you want to add yours, not too late. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be happy to hear from you and to know what you thought of that recent debate. Thanks also to Ed, who's been in touch and didn't have time to read out your email, and Peter and others. So many emails each week, and not always time to get to all of them. But do appreciate you sending them in, and do continue to send them in. And I've had some that are about, you know, possible show ideas and that kind of thing as well. And I like to have those as well. All goes into the pot to making what might be the next Unbelievable programme. And lots of interesting ones to come as well. Setting up one soon with Nick Spencer, who's the author of The Origin of the Species, a new book on atheism, which will be very interesting. So look out for that in September. Going to be hearing from Graham Ward as well in the not too distant future. He's the Regius Professor of Theology, of Divinity, sorry, at Oxford University, on a new book called Unbelievable. And next week, we've got another programme for you, of course. So let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
I'm going to be joined by Callum Miller and James Croft. Callum Miller is a young Christian apologist, very intelligent young guy. He's in his final year training as a medic from Oxford University, but he's developed a passion for theology and philosophy in particular. He's in fact presented a number of philosophy papers, and he's going to be talking about his latest area of research, which is what he calls the argument from induction, essentially boiling down to, is theism or atheism the best explanation for life, the universe and everything? And we're going to be hearing a discussion between him and James Croft next week. James Croft is a humanist. He is the kind of equivalent, really, of a humanist chaplain to a sort of humanist community out in the States. He's a Brit, though, himself, and he'll be here to engage with Callum, because James has a background himself in philosophy. So expect one of those ones that challenges the old grey matter next week as we tackle that sort of philosophical kind of a subject. I do hope you can come back for more from Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon here as part of Faith Explored. And coming up next, we've got the profile interview between 4 and 5. Dave Rose here after 5. I do hope you're enjoying this August season, and I hope you can come back again same time next week for Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking. Until then, thanks for being with me.